From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It took him a while to figure this out, but the writer Michael Pollan says if you're going to grow a garden, you're going to have to pull some weeds, put up a fence, and, you know, tidy up nature, which at first seemed wrong to him. He had read the romantic nature writers, and he figured the choice was either dominate the land or just give in to it. But over time, Pollan found a middle path, one that allows for wilderness and for plowing into the dirt and making something grow. Michael Pollan is coming to Utah this week. He'll join us to talk about his education in the garden, which led him to be a writer and then an activist about food. We'll also talk about his latest interest in nature, plants that alter consciousness. Join us after the news.
Hey, Radio West listener. We thought you'd want to know that the book we're talking about on today's podcast just happens to be available on Audible. Go to RadioWest.org and you'll find a link included with the show, along with links to IndieBound and Amazon, and any purchases you make through these affiliate partners help support Radio West. Thanks so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's a little teaser for Michael Pollan's next book, which isn't out until next year. Pollan says plants don't just nourish our bodies. There are plants that can nourish us psychologically, too. He's talking about psychedelic mushrooms and catnip and loco weed and opium, plants that get you high, that alter your consciousness. Michael Pollan is coming to Utah this week. We'll give you some details about that a little bit later. He writes about food and cooking and diet. He critiques industrial agriculture and the American food system. In our conversation, we talked about all of those things, though we began with a subject that got him thinking about all of that stuff in the first place, the garden.
The garden represents an ideal of nature that we all carry around in our heads, that the culture carries around in its head, of a place that's kind of perfect harmony between ourselves and the rest of creation. And it's a beautiful idea. It shows up in the Bible, of course, and as this ideal state from which we fall away. And then there's the real place, which is much messier and requires us to make compromises, where harmony is a joke very often.
Yeah.
And takes real work. It's a product of labor. It's the mixing of the work of our hands with what nature provides. And I think we get stuck very often between those two ideals and I know I did when I started to garden, because I I had that ideal very much in my head, and largely as a result of the reading I had done. I mean, I was an English major, and I read lots of literature about gardens and nature and wilderness. And so I came to the garden with a head full of beautiful ideas about nature that I was promptly disabused of.
Right. There's something Wendell Berry wrote in his book, Tobacco Harvest, mm-hmm. an elegy, that I encountered a few months ago. I know Wendell Berry is important in the way you came to thinking about this.
Oh, yeah. He helped me enormously.
Enormously. We'll get back to that. But this was something that I found really interesting. Berry said there's an idealism native to farming, and that farmers always begin the year with this vision of perfection. But then that vision gets whittled down over the year by, creatures and pests and weather. And I wanted to read this because it seems to sort of get at where you... a revelation you had.
Yeah, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, he says, the crop year is a long struggle ended invariably not by the desired perfection, but by the need to accept something less than perfection as the best that could be done.
Mm. That's beautiful. But of course, it applies to everything we do, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I just finished writing a book, and I'm feeling exactly that. And there is the vision we have. Or if you're making a movie or a radio program, I mean, you have an ideal of how you hope this is going to come out, and then it bumps up against reality. And it's a frustrating, but it's also a beautiful process. If everything just came out the way we planned it, of course, there'd be no surprises and no learning. And no wisdom gained.
Yeah.
So I think it's very much the way of the world. I think we're always kind of dealing with, you know, those aspects of nature that we can't control. And figuring out exactly what we can and can't control is a big part of gardening, and it's a big part of life.
Yeah. Why do you think Americans who were writing about nature, and maybe even today, maybe this still applies, but this is what you had written in Second Nature. You talked about how people who were writing about nature don't or didn't write about the garden. Why do you think that is? And do you think, is that still so?
Well, Americans have had a very different attitude toward toward the natural world, I think, than a lot of other cultures. And there are religious ideas and political ideas behind that. We came to this country, and when I say we, I mean the original English settlers, on a religious mission, and that the entire country represented a promised land. And that Europe was fallen in part of history and messy, and here was this new place, this frontier, that we would make into this city on a hill. And it was a beautiful and noble idea in many ways, but it also required us to overlook many things because, you know, among other things, there were people already here that we kind of wrote out of our beautiful vision. And so to make a distinction between the good parts and the bad parts, the garden and the wilderness, say, no, it was all a garden. It was all, you know, turning back the biblical clock to the Garden of Eden. And so, whereas in Europe, people, you know, gardens were privileged places located within the messy landscape of the city or the farm or whatever. And but here, we to make a distinction between the garden and the and what was outside of it. So we were very hostile to things like fences, for example, because they denote, and you see this in Emerson and Thoreau, and you see it in actually you see it back in Anne Bradstreet, who was, you know, really arguably the first American poet. I remember reading her poetry. And there was this whole tradition of English poetry, the hortus conclusus, the walled garden. And it was this beautiful Renaissance conceit. And she just completely upends it because she says it's all a garden. The birds I hear, the wilderness, the things outside. There's no inside and outside. We're here in America. It's all a garden. It was a very radical idea. And that really sets the goal, the incredibly ambitious goal that we're going to treat the whole country as a garden, which, of course, you can't do. So we start from a different place, and if you're a gardener, these ideas, as you know, beautiful as they might be, really are disastrous in practice. You know, I learned as soon as I, you know, beholden to these ideas, I didn't put a fence around my first garden, and 'cause it was so old world, it was so English, And that's when my education really began.
I'm going to dig down on this idea a little bit more, but I want to back up just a bit. You grew up on Long Island. Your father barely went outside. Mm-hmm.
I describe him as a great indoorsman.
Yeah, a great indoorsman, exactly. But your grandfather, I mean, he was very successful in the produce business. You describe him as old world peasant and real estate developer. So he had these two parts to his nature, loved not the land, but loved land,
yeah.
which he developed. But he also loved gardens. Talk a little bit about your grandfather's influence on your ideas, and then we'll come back to your father, which is
they were the two poles of my early education about the land, but it was my grandfather to whom I was drawn because he was a wonderful gardener. He came here as a, I don't know, 12 or 13 from Russia in around 1917, escaping the conscription of everybody that age, and came here with no English at all and began working his way up. I mean, he sold produce on the street. And then gradually started having relations with farmers, and he became a distributor of produce, and he distributed produce during the war, World War II on Long Island, and through his relationships with farmers, he began to buy their land and develop it in various ways. And so he started with the produce and got to the land and then became a developer. But he never gave up his love of fresh produce. His delight he would take in a beefsteak tomato or a tree-ripened peach was just a wonder to behold. And he had this very large garden. They lived, my first memories of him, they were living in Babylon, which is right on the coast in Suffolk County. And they were right near the water, and which is often a good place to garden because it moderates the temperature. And you can use seaweed as mulch. It's an excellent mulch and things like that. And he had this, it must have been a quarter acre, and there were just the two of them, my grandmother and him. And he grew huge amounts of tomatoes and squash and melons and peppers. And he was not an organic gardener by any means. There were tons of, you know, bottles of pesticide. He would use anything technology had to offer. And sometimes the smells in the garden were distinctly more chemical than natural. And it was absolutely pristine, weedless. It was gorgeous. And I enjoyed nothing more than working in the garden, you know, side by side with him, and especially harvesting. I mean, I just found harvesting. It was just, you know, it was a treasure hunt. You know, Candyland was my favorite board game. And this was Candyland, you know, writ large. Even that I didn't necessarily love eating tomatoes or anything like that, but you know, as you'll see with any kid, food fresh out of the garden, they will eat things that they wouldn't eat under any other circumstance because it's so sweet and satisfying. You know, they're doing it themselves. Now, it's not like I had such a harmonious relationship with him, I should add. He was a very kind of reactionary guy, and my hair was too long, and I wore a little leather braided bracelet that he just thought was suspicious, and he was, you know, he was always worried his grandkids would turn into hippies, as he called them. And that danger, you know, was ever present. And there was a lot we couldn't connect on. But we could connect on gardening. So that was really the basis for our relationship. And I learned a lot from him. But it certainly gave me the bug. And by comparison, my dad, who was, you know, his idea of gardening was standing in the garage, fooling with the, because we did have this lawn and kind of, you know, intricate landscape, but fooling with the irrigation system, which was constantly thwarting his desires and leading to the death of sections of the lawn. And he, you know, for him, gardening was pure frustration, partly because we had a very shady yard and nothing that he planted would grow in it. And he would hire us to weed. I mean, that was definitely one of our jobs as kids. He had no interest. And part of his lack of interest was the fact that he didn't get along with his father-in-law, who was was never good. I mean, he was never good enough for my mom. And my grandfather would, you know, just out of the blue send over a crew with, you know, 30 rhododendrons because he felt that the driveway needed them, you know, along lining it, and, you know, without asking my dad, he found rather outrageous.
There's a great story you tell about your father, and this may be before you moved into the house that had the elaborate sprinkling system, but it was...
Oh, yeah, it was.
When it was the year of... It seems like this kind of the summer of defiance where he kind of refused to mow the lawn.
Yeah, you know, my dad was never a good citizen of the suburbs, and there's certain things that go with that citizenship, and prime among them is the maintenance of your front lawn. The front lawn is a weird space in the American landscape because it's yours. Technically, you own it, but you don't have the freedom to do with it what you want. You must obey the convention of the neighborhood, which is uninterrupted front lawns so that one flows into the other. And there's a deep history to that I talk about in Second Nature. It goes back to this idea of America as this you know, ideal, this beautiful garden. And it was going to be a landscape garden in the English style, which meant rolling lawns. And it was weird. You had to do it in the front lawn. In the backyard, you could do whatever you wanted. And the other weird thing about the front lawn is nobody used it. This is the most beautiful piece of land you own. It's usually have more front yard than backyard, but it was too exposed, so nobody ever went out except to maintain their lawns. And this is still true in most of America. It's absolutely insane. And I won't even go into all the environmental problems of maintaining lawns where they shouldn't be. So my dad, but he protested this institution, but I have to say it was more laziness than anything else. He didn't like to mow, and he didn't have enough money to pay someone else to mow. So we would mow only when, you know, my mom got on his case. And it wasn't like it was such a big lawn, but he also didn't like his neighbors that much. We were one of the few Jewish families in this community, and he never felt really welcomed. And so if he could say screw you to the neighbors by not mowing, that was fine with him. I mean, he is a very independent person. He's not a conformist by any means. And so the mowing got worse and worse. And one summer he just let it go completely. And you had, you know, lawn, 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 meadow, lawn, lawn, lawn. And to call ours a meadow is pretty generous, but it was a patch of weeds. And it grew, you know, it was up to my waist, and it got really tense. I mean, it's really amazing how much political energy is behind this institution. And the neighbors whispered about it. I would hear about it when I went to school. There were, you know, kids not allowed to play with me or come over. And because my dad had made clear his dissent from the common good here. And anyway, he had one good friend in the neighborhood, a guy named George Hackett. And George was pressured by the neighbors one day to say, you got to talk to Steve about this lawn. It's ruining our property values. And that's always, you know, the great currency of the suburbs. Is things are either good or bad for property values. And that phrase is used to disguise racism and all sorts of, you know, terrible things. And so George came over, and very timorously, he was kind of a small, somewhat timid guy, but a wonderful guy and a good friend of my dad's, and said, Steve, you've really got to mow the lawn. The neighbors are up in arms, and they're twisting my arm. So my dad, without comment, goes out to the garage and cranks up the old Toro lawnmower and wheels it out to the lawn and starts mowing in this weird pattern that's not rectangular or beginning at the edges. And he does an S, and then he mows an M, and then he mows a P, which were his initials, SMP. And that was it. That's all he mowed. Anyway, it's one of the great stories of my dad. But as soon as he could afford to have someone else give him a fancy, front lawn and take care of it, he did.
He did, right.
So it was mixed motives, but laziness was definitely in there.
That's Michael Pollan. His books include Cooked and The Omnivore's Dilemma. Tomorrow night, he's going to be at Red Butte Garden for a fundraiser for the International Rescue Committee's Refugee Gardening Program. That event is sold out, but if you want to learn more about the new Roots program, there's a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the writer Michael Pollan, who is coming to Utah this week. We're having a conversation about what he's learned about the natural world as a gardener. You were talking earlier about how you were looking for the right kind of philosophical guidance about your garden, because Thoreau and Emerson, that just wasn't realistic. It wasn't really working. And at some point in this process, you discover, I guess, Wendell Berry. Is that right?
Yeah, he was key. I mean, you know, I'm the kind of person who, when I do anything new, I first read a bunch of books. Yeah. And it's one of the reasons I like to do new things, because it's an excuse to have a reading list and then to read with some sense of purpose. You know, you're trying to extract something. I mean, I love that. Every time I start a new book, I start with a book list. And I get to learn this history and this philosophy and this literature. And it's great fun. I came to gardening, though, as really as a student of Thoreau and Emerson and that whole great American tradition of nature writing, which is by and large, you know, favors the wild landscape over the garden.
Yeah.
and looks at gardens as kind of a feat. And so I did have this head full of Thoreau and Emerson, and it got me into trouble. I mean, I didn't know how to deal with weeds, because Emerson had said that weeds are just a defect of our perception. In other words, they don't really exist. It's just a plant we dislike for our own personal reasons. And that's, by the way, completely untrue. Weeds are a specific class of plants that only thrive in areas we disturb. So he was wrong about that, but I believe that. Yeah. So, and Thoreau too, he couldn't convince himself when he planted a bean field at Walden to you know, that was going to be his cash crop to support his little project in independent living. It's 2 miles of rows of beans he planted. He couldn't justify to himself why the what he called the invidious distinctions he made between the weeds and his beans, and why the birds shouldn't be as entitled to the beans as we were. I mean, that's kind of how far they went. So finding Wendell Berry was a lifesaver for me. I mean, here was a writer, by the way, whose prose is as good as either Emerson's or Thoreau's. I mean, he's a wonderful writer. But he was a farmer, and a farmer is very different. You know, a farmer, and this is one of the reasons I admire farmers so much, is that they can't just have a set of ideas and philosophies. They have to be geniuses of the practical world. They have to make it work. And they're, you know, some of the most practical people there are. And they're constantly testing ideas and intentions against the, you know, in the crucible of nature as it really is. So Wendell Berry, who addressed a lot of the same issues and directly criticized Thoreau in various ways or supplemented him. I remember, you know, there's a famous line in Thoreau, in wildness is the preservation of the world. You know, sounds like a really nice idea. And Berry adds to that. And in culture is the preservation of wildness. Only through culture will we preserve wildness, because wildness requires us to restrain ourselves. And that's what culture is, a set of restraints on human greed and ignorance and things like that. So he really, and he taught me, he actually has a line that, where he says at one point, we have a legitimate quarrel with nature. And when I read that, it was totally liberating, because I was being beset by weeds and woodchucks and deer. And I didn't feel harmonious feelings toward them. I felt homicidal or whatever the equivalent is, herbicidal and deericidal thoughts toward them. And he made me realize that's fine. That's fine. The challenge is figuring out how far to take those feelings and how to develop a kind of middle ground between our intentions and what nature's going to do. So he really taught me how to garden, and he taught me how to write to a large extent also. I mean, he was a really key figure, and I love his essays for the way they're put together, for the beauty of his sentences, and the really hard-won wisdom about how to behave in nature. There's a guide to living in his work, and there's certainly a guide to the environment, and a very powerful critique of industrial agriculture that, you know, went on to become a very important part of my work.
Yeah. There's a story you tell in that first book about this battle with a woodchuck. And I wanted you to talk about it because I think it reveals what you were just talking about, how you came to realize some of our, as you described them, darker attitudes about nature.
Yeah, I really got in touch with definitely the dark side of our attitudes toward nature and our sense of entitlement and control. Well, when I first had my own garden on my own land, I was in my late 20s, and we bought this sliver of a rundown farmhouse in Cornwall, Connecticut, about 2 hours from New York City, a very rural area. And I put in raised beds, and I double dug them and did everything you're supposed to do, you know, all that backbreaking work one spring, you know, digging them to the depth of 2 feet and improving the soil. And planted my seedlings, which I bought at the garden center, and within a day they were snipped off an inch above the ground, every single one, you know. And I came out and I was like, "What the hell was that?" And I replanted, and it happened again, and I realized from my reading that it was a woodchuck and not a deer because it was so systematic. There was no fear on the part of this creature. And it was just this, you know, mowing down of my garden. And I started going after him. I found his burrow, which is never very far from a garden because they can't see very well and they don't like to cross too much open land. And I stuffed his burrow full of rocks and soil. And within a day, the rocks and soil had been spat out and he was back at work. And then I started, you know, putting things down his burrow to discourage him. And people who think of me as an environmental writer are sometimes shocked to learn that I was, you know, pouring creosote down there, you know, just emptying the garage and hoping to discourage him. And at one point, I even scooped up a dead woodchuck I'd found, some roadkill, this flattened woodchuck, and scooped it onto a piece of cardboard and shoved that in the hole. And then he dug a detour around it. And I finally did something I'm not proud of, which is I had seen this story on the evening news about a new fuel that they were going to use on jetliners and that it would burn more slowly if there was a crash. And they'd rigged up this old 707 and with a camera and ignited the fuel. And they had footage of this, you know, flames racing down this narrow corridor, you know, really fast. And didn't work. The fuel didn't work, obviously. And so I thought, that's exactly what I want to see happen to this woodchuck in his burrow. So I poured like a gallon of gasoline down the burrow. And I think I mentioned earlier I was an English major and not a physics major, because if I had been a physics major, I wouldn't have done what I did, which was throw a match in it, thinking that the fire would follow the fuel. But of course, fire has a thing about oxygen. So the flames burst the other way. There was this fountain of flames coming out of this burrow right by my garden. I almost incinerated the whole thing. And this shocked me into a reconsideration of my horticultural methods. But it also put me in touch with this sense that, you know, who is this dim-witted animal to thwart us? I mean, it was a little like Bill Murray in Caddyshack also. But, you know, I've learned over time that all creatures in nature, including plants, have a kind of intelligence for doing what they do and living the way they need to live. And we automatically assume that we have the superior intelligence. And so there was a lot. I really saw our arrogance. And I described this episode as my horticultural Vietnam, because of the escalation and the ultimate disaster. But it did shock me. That's what sent me to Wendell Berry. And that's what sent me looking for, there has to be another way to approach this. This isn't working. Because the way I'm doing it is the way industrial agriculture does it, too. This sense of wiping every challenge to us off the land, rather than figuring out a way to coexist.
Well, as you say in the book, you found a kind of middle ground, that it wasn't necessarily a harmonious compromise, that if you're going to make a garden, you have to intervene. You have to cut into the land. But you say the question for all of us is, what then is the proper character of that intervention?
Well, that's right. Intervention. I mean, and I think that's why it's messy. I mean, we love the black or white, you know, control or acquiescence, you know, so we have a landscape that looks like that. You know, somewhere between, I don't know, 8% and 12% of the American landscape has been preserved as wilderness, which is a wonderful thing. I mean, we invented that idea of the wilderness park. It's one of America's great contributions to world culture. And we had an ethic that told us how to do that, that comes out of Thoreau and John Muir and Emerson. But then what do you do with the rest of it? Well, anything goes. I mean, we've really, for a very long time, you know, you either have, you know, it's virgin land or it's raped, right? I mean, that's kind of how we see things. And the middle ground, which is really what the garden should represent and what good agriculture represents, is something we've been much less good at. Because for a long time, the people who thought about nature at all thought about wilderness. And you couldn't get the Nature Conservancy interested or the Sierra Club interested in anything that was agricultural or, you know, they just wanted the pure stuff. And that was a real limitation of American environmentalism for a long time, I think. And so it was, but we can't do that for all of nature. We can't get what we need to survive merely in wilderness. We have, and so we have to intervene. And that's what the gardener and the farmer has to teach the culture, because they learn how to intervene in a way that is literally sustainable, which that can be done year after year after year. And even that in America was a new idea. You know, we tended to farm the land intensely and then move on after we ruined it, because we had so much of it. I mean, there's something about a sense of infinitude that leads to great waste. And for America, especially as we moved west, well, if this part didn't work, we'll go further west and we'll find another part that will. And but the gardener, you know, he's got his land and he's going to stay there, and he's got to make it work, and make it work not just this year, but next year and the year after. And the book, Second Nature, really becomes a meditation on what should the character of that intervention be? Where are the models? And there are models. Nature gives us models, actually.
Michael Pollan, he's the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma and Cooked, which is also a documentary miniseries on Netflix. Tomorrow night, he's going to be giving a lecture at Red Butte Garden as part of the International Rescue Committee's fundraiser, their refugee gardening program. The event, I should say, is sold out, but if you do want to learn more about that program, you can find a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the writer Michael Pollan. Over the last few years, I want to ask you about the work you've been doing on psychedelic drugs. What got you thinking about this? What interests you about this?
Yeah, well, it sounds like a big departure to some people, I think, to go from this concern with the issues of nature and the stomach to the brain and science. But to me, there's a kind of logic to it. You know, my big subject as a writer, which is spelled out most clearly, I think, in my first book, Second Nature, which really has the kernel of everything I've done since, I think, really is how the human engagement with the natural world, the character of that engagement, and the effects of that engagement. And that, of course, if you do that, for me, it began in the garden and the library, but it ended up looking at the food system because agriculture is a very powerful place where we engage with the natural world, probably more powerful than anything else in terms of affecting nature and affecting us. And I've always been interested in that reciprocal relationship. But one of the really curious dimensions of that relationship is our use of plants and fungi to change consciousness. And in fact, in my third book, The Botany of Desire, which is called A Plant's Eye View of the World, is the subtitle, I looked at this reciprocal relationship in four different plants, each of which had evolved to gratify a human desire, and that became their evolutionary strategy. And I looked at the potato, and I looked at the tulip, and I looked at cannabis, marijuana. And I thought that was a very curious thing, that plants should have evolved the biochemistry to actually change the contents of our consciousness, and that we should have discovered it, and that they should have discovered it. And so I have had this longstanding interest. One of the things people grow in their gardens are consciousness-altering plants.
So that tells you that there's some adaptive advantage to changing your consciousness.
Well, that's what it suggests. And I think that that is true. I think that, I mean, in general, drugs have a very bad reputation, and they cause all sorts of problems, and they're powerful forces. But I think one of the questions we have to ask is, why have people sought to change consciousness for all over history. There's not a culture that except for one example I'll give you, that doesn't use plants and fungi to change consciousness, and that is the Inuit, the Eskimos, because no such plants happen to exist where they live. But as soon as they're exposed to them, they too, you know, get interested in alcohol and things like that. And, you know, I do think it has an adaptive value. I think that, first, it helps people deal with pain, which is a you know, age-old problem. Mm-hmm. It helps people deal with boredom. And mm-hmm. so there are these very basic things that it does. But I argue in Botany and Desire and in this new book I'm working on that it has more profound effects, that it kind of shakes up ideas about reality. And it is, the number of artists who, you know, will credit some involvement with a psychedelic or other kinds of drugs with creative breakthroughs and with new ideas. I mean, Steve Jobs famously spoke about the influence of LSD on his aesthetic and the path he took. And, you know, he was just more open than a lot of other people. So I'm very interested in that. Why is it adaptive? And why is it adaptive for the plants, obviously, too? These are not, sometimes they're defense chemicals, but sometimes they're not. They're actually, that was the plant's strategy to get ahead. So then I stumbled on the case of psychedelics, which I had known very little about. And I didn't have the classic 60s period. I was a little too young for that and a little too fearful. But I started reading about this revival of research into psychedelics, specifically psilocybin, which is the chemical in magic mushrooms, and that it was being used, and this struck me as strange and fascinating, but with people with terminal cancer diagnoses who were suffering from profound anxiety about either death or recurrence, and fear and depression, and that they were having these trips, they weren't just taking mushrooms out and walking around the woods. They were in a very controlled environment with guides and therapists present the whole time, and that they were having experiences that profoundly changed their minds and their attitude toward death. And I wrote about this in The New Yorker 2 years ago, and that really is what launched me on the book, because I was fascinated to learn, well, why should that be? Why should a mushroom that grows in the woods be able to induce what is, in effect, a mystical experience, a profound spiritual experience in people that changes how they feel about death? And what's the science of that? What's the psychology of that? And that sent me down this path, and which I've been on for the last 3 years, actually, learning about this.
Maybe, Michael Pauly, could you explain what a trip is like? Because I think it's interesting how you describe, at least in that New Yorker article, how they're all different in all kinds of different ways. But there are a few common themes that kind of emerge. And a trip is very much different from a dream.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting. One of the things that really struck me is people would tell me these stories about their trips. And they'd have these wild episodes of witnessing the birth of life and or the history of humankind, and they travel all around the world and be in ancient Rome and then in Mayan temples and places that they actually knew very little about often. And you would ask them about this later, and it did not have the character of a dream at all, because it was absolutely vivid and easy for them to recall. They could recall it as if this was literally a trip they'd taken, you know, to another country or something like that. There is a vividness of it that, you know, dreams were very quickly they're very evanescent, and they slip away if you don't write them down or think about them most of the time. I mean, we dream all the time. We don't remember our dreams. Not true for these psychedelic trips. These were, people described them as in the top 3 or 5 most significant experiences of their lives. And that a drug could give you this, a chemical. And yet, of course, it wasn't the same for everybody, as you suggest. It's very much a product of your mind. It's not a product of the chemical. What the chemical appears to be doing is loosening the kind of regulator or the filters in your consciousness, allowing material to bubble up and come into conscious awareness. And that could include memories. A lot of people remember scenes from their childhood with incredible detail, and often traumas from their childhood. I mean, that's one of the scary things that happen to people on trips, because there are bad trips too. Although bad trips, when in the presence of a very good therapist, or can be turned into incredibly productive experiences for somebody. I mean, it's, and there's a lot of work going on with PTSD using not psilocybin usually, but another drug called MDMA that allows people to re-experience trauma in a way that's less scary or less freighted, and then and help them deal with it in that way. So, you know, one of the interesting things about the neuroscience here is that there is a part of, there seems to be one particular brain network, the default mode network, which is the site of your, it's several different brain structures tightly linked, where self-reflection seems to take place, time travel, thinking about the past or the future, some of the neuroscience I talked to said this is basically where the ego is. This is where the self is in the brain. And that exerts a kind of powerful orchestration role for the rest of the brain. It keeps things out of our conscious awareness. It filters things. So we're not overwhelmed either by our past or by the information that is coming from the environment. And this part of the brain is quieted during the psychedelic trip. And so, you know, the ego that's normally in control is kind of put to sleep for a while. And that experience, which can be frightening at first, if you can surrender to it, can be transformative and wonderful in many ways. I mean, this sense of merging with nature, merging with other people, feeling less apart. And for the cancer patients coping with death, this became what one of the psychologists described to me as death practice. And that you can see that if you let go of this self that you think is so important to your existence, this sense of being part of a larger entity is very reassuring to people. And is you know, the classic, I mean, if you read the great religious mystics, they talk about that, the loss of the sense of self and the merging with something larger, whether they call it God or nature or it doesn't really matter. So we're in a funny realm here where science and spirituality are mixing it up, and it appears to have some very interesting therapeutic applications, especially for anxiety and depression.
It's interesting you've talked about how this subject has been a different kind of reporting for you, because when you're talking to someone about this experience, it's really, you've said, extremely emotional.
Oh, yeah. No, these interviews, I mean, I have now interviewed, I don't know, probably 20 people who've had these high-dose experiences, in university studies. And they're not like interviewing farmers or food company executives, I have to tell you. they're incredibly personal. And people start telling you, you know, the most intimate things about themselves and this experience, which is, of course, the product of their subconscious. And they're very moved by it and eager to tell the story. It's very interesting. It kind of makes people into compulsive storytellers. But they're often very tearful too. And they go on too. Each of these interviews would be like 2 hours minimum. And for me, it was, out of my comfort zone as an interviewer in terms of learning how to deal with people who were crying in an interview and dealing with the hardest parts of their lives, and doing that in such a way that was, empathetic and open, and because you don't want to press people in that situation. Yeah. But I seldom had to. And in one way, it was easy. But you really had to make them feel safe. That was kind of the goal. And it's been a very different kind of journalism. And that's what I like about it. You know, as a writer, I much prefer to write as an amateur or as a novice or a naive than I do as an expert. Yeah. And frankly, about food and agriculture, I had written several books and, was too much of an expert to write with the kind of sense of wonder that I like to write with.
Yeah.
And so for me, the greatest experience as a writer is to start out on a new landscape. And, you know, I mean, not entirely new. As I said, there were continuities here. This still is, to me, part of this wonderful question about nature. And that this, you know, and that a lot of my work has been expanding our understanding of, well, what is nature? It's not just the plants and animals outside your window. It's you or parts of you. It's your engagement with that. It's what makes you human. I mean, we are animals too. We're just peculiar ones. And, and changing consciousness, having consciousness is a big part of what we do. And one of the things that also happens on these experiences too, is you see the world in a less objectified way. I mean, in general, most of the time we see ourselves as the only thinking subject and the rest of the world is a bunch of objects. And maybe people close to us get to have subjecthood and feelings and their own attitudes. But in general, we tend to objectify everything. Well, one of the things people report on these psychedelic journeys is that the world is much more alive than they thought. That subjectivity is spread more widely over it than they thought. And that extends not just to animals and other people, but to plants too, that suddenly have a point of view. And that's something I've always believed intellectually. But it's very interesting that people have that experience.
Let me finally, Michael, bring us back around to the food movement. You were, of course, you had high hopes for the Obama administration, and you were, in many ways, and you've written about this, disappointed. But you also talk about how the Obamas were fairly quickly out-lobbied and outgunned by this massive industry. And you say, you've written this, that the food movement still barely exists as a political force today. So are you feeling pessimistic in light of a new administration with clearly different ideas, I'm guessing, about regulation and industry?
Well, you know, there are two big arenas where these issues are playing out. And one is the political arena in Congress and the White House. And the other is the economy and the society. So you have to realize that they're on different tracks. And as much as, you know, Trump seems intent on turning back anything the Obamas did, just because it was the Obamas and that's how he governs, he's not able to stop things. I mean, when we see this, you know, where the Obamas set in motion, and I use Obamas plural, of course, because Michelle had the key role on food issues, that they set in motion changes that even though they didn't win many legislative victories or regulatory victories, nevertheless changed the culture. So, you know, in that sense, I mean, we have to credit them for that. They talked about food more than anyone in the White House ever has. Michelle Obama's example with the garden and the work she did on school food, and just simply elevated the profile of the issue, in a way it had never been. And that, the effects of that go on. The food industry, you know, just watch the food industry and the way they're gobbling up, small startups and organic food companies and the growth of the organic market. And you're watching the entire food industry hustle to keep up with a food culture that's been shaped by the food movement. And so that will go on. You know, whatever setbacks Trump has in store and whatever deregulation of food he pursues, and his agenda on these issues is, to my mind, deplorable in many ways. It goes on in the economy. It goes on in the culture. And, you know, we are, purchase by purchase, building an alternative food system, alternative food economy. And it's growing faster than the conventional food economy. And it's going to be absorbed by that conventional food economy, which will in turn be changed by having absorbed it. So change, you know, so in many ways, I'm very optimistic. You know, I was criticizing Obama because that's how you push, you know, the political, I mean, I think he needed critics on many issues to push him, where he, you know, finally he decided that there wasn't yet enough political power behind the food movement to make big changes. And he was probably right about that. It would have been premature. He had a lot of battles to fight. He had a completely recalcitrant Senate. Mitch McConnell had declared at the very beginning he wasn't going to let him make a record on anything, and he had a financial crisis to fight. I mean, I'm totally sympathetic to his position. There were a couple things they did where they raised hopes among farmers, especially, and then dropped the ball. On antitrust enforcement and things like that. And that was, I think, tragic. But when we look back on this, when from the vantage of a food system that is much more focused on health and sustainability, and we will have that food system, we will see the Obama administration as one of the turning points.
It's interesting. It kind of brings us back to Wendell Berry, that it's culture that really matters.
Yes, it is. It's always culture. Culture is, precedes politics, and you have to change the culture before you can change the politics. You know, one of the things I learned getting involved in these issues, and I'm politically very naive, but I found myself drawn into the role of an advocate or activist on food issues after having been a journalist on it for a long time, is that you realize that Washington is seldom ahead of anything, that it's not a leading indicator. And that the states are where you should look for change, and because they're a little closer to the culture and the economy too. And so, Wendell's exactly right, and perhaps it's no coincidence that the Obamas gave him one of the top awards that the president can give in the area of the humanities, and they also gave it to Alice Waters, and that will stand too as part of their legacy. So I'm feeling sunnier, but you can understand why. I mean, given what's going on.
It's Michael Pollan, who's been writing about food and culture for some 25 years now. Among his books, Second Nature, A Gardener's Education, and The Omnivore's Dilemma. He also has the book Cooked, which has been made into a documentary miniseries for Netflix. Tomorrow night, he's giving a lecture at Red Butte Garden. It's part of the International Rescue Committee's fundraiser for their refugee gardening program. That event is sold out, but if you want to learn more about that program, there is a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Lacey Roberts in Berkeley, California. Our intern is Zoe Wolf-McGinn, the program directed today by Michael Havey, produced by Benjamin Bombard, Annie Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.